Today, our guest is Joshua Wenning, a good friend of mine. Thanks for stopping by.
My pleasure. Thanks for the invitation, Jason.
Yeah, this is all new, and I hope we have, I think we both have great radio voices.
So I know I have a face for radio. I've been told that, so I hope so. Hopefully no, the voice is okay.
I have a face for radio. And you're in the same boat. I've told Clinton this, that if we did this on YouTube, this would be the Beauty and the Beast show. So
hardly.
You and I should do baseball.
We could.
Baseball or golf. We should be commentators in golf.
I think that'd be fantastic.
All right. So if anybody's listening in ESPN, we're ready to submit our resumes.
We're ready.
So you had a unique background. Tell us where you were born.
So I was born out in Spokane, Washington. Mm-hmm. My parents were living out there and actually had just moved there from the Midwest. And that led to... I actually have no memories from there. We moved to Bloomington, Indiana shortly after that. Mm-hmm. And before I even started kindergarten, we moved to Portland, Oregon. So wow. Before I was five, we'd kind of almost had two major cross-country moves. Kind of remembered Bloomington at that point, but definitely Portland as kind of where my formative years began.
So were you in witness protection or the military?
The FBI caught up with us and it was time to move.
Right.
I don't have a good answer for the Spokane to Bloomington move, but the Bloomington to Portland move was, I do know what that was. My parents were younger Christians and at the time, and my dad felt a calling to go into the ministry, and he identified a seminary in Portland, Oregon that he wanted to attend, and he and my mom committed our family to moving there and going to seminary, and that's what we did. That's what took us to Portland, Oregon. And where he went to seminary and eventually became a pastor.
That takes some guts. I mean, this is like, you've got obligations, you've got children.
Yeah.
And what was he doing before that?
That's an excellent question. I should have been more prepared on that specific question. He was in the Air Force prior to us kids coming along. Once we came along, he was, gosh, that's a great question, Jason.
Well,
I'm embarrassed
to
say I don't know what he was doing prior to that.
That's okay. I was just curious if it was one of those like situations that you hear about people leaving, you know, like these really well-paying jobs and doubling down at seminary and taking this faith journey.
Well, and I take that. So, I know that they had done some work with Campus Crusade for Christ. Let me take that back. So they were in Oklahoma. That's what they were in Oklahoma before going to Spokane. So, no, they were not leaving a lucrative lifestyle, certainly in any sense. When we were in Bloomington, we were living on my grandparents' farm. They had a one-bedroom, very, very small house that we lived in. So it was not a matter of leaving any kind of lucrative lifestyle or large salary. It was definitely, and one thing that I know about my dad that has been consistently true, and my mom for their entire lives, has been a desire to follow God's calling for their life and living that every single day.
Right.
We'll probably touch on this a little later, but my dad is in his mid-70s and still teaching at a Christian school in the Detroit area.
Wow.
And purposely choosing to teach middle school Bible.
Wow.
When he could very easily be teaching at a college advanced level with his knowledge and understanding of the Bible. But he chooses that because he feels God's called him to have an impact on the lives of middle schoolers who are in the midst of forming their worldview that will be very important to them for the rest of their lives. And then my mom, who's taught in a Christian school her entire career and just recently retired in the last few years, again in her early 70s. So I see that connecting back to your question about what took us out there was they were very, very serious about seeking God's calling for their life and how they can have the biggest impact on the kingdom.
That seems like a solid way to hit your mid-70s and say, I have no regrets.
Yeah. I think...
I mean, everybody's going to have some regrets, but to say, I was doing what I was meant to be doing.
I have no doubt, and my dad would say that without a doubt. In fact, we're trying to get him to retire because, I mean, he's in his mid-70s. His body is not full, you know, is not
at
what it was.
Kids, right?
And, but he says, no, I feel like God is calling me to be here. Like, well, who are we to argue with what God has called for your life, right?
So what I find interesting about that is I imagine somebody that's older, seen some life, you know, being really good with middle school kids, that energy and the ridiculousness that is middle school kids, and just being able to roll with it, knowing what's important and what's like, well, that's just them being a 13-year-old.
Yeah.
And this is the important thing.
Yeah.
So you grew up a pastor's kid. What is that like for people that don't know?
So we were at a small church in Portland, Oregon, a place called Happy Valley. And it was a really cool place. Mm-hmm. It's very different now than when it was then. It's just outside of Portland. And it is this little, at the time, this little like rural oasis. Mm-hmm. And it really was a valley. And when you go to the top edge of one of the hills, you're looking out over the city of Portland. So now it's built up and there's very, very nice homes there. It's a very mm-hmm. different vibe and feel there. But for us, it was, I think for me, it was really interesting. It was really cool. Some things that I thought about the question was, as a upper elementary age kid, elementary age to middle school age kid, I certainly, as the oldest of four kids, I felt a certain level of pressure. Mm-hmm. I'm the oldest. I'm the pastor's kid. Mm-hmm. Everyone knows who we are. So no matter what we do, people are going to see us doing it. So if I'm not paying as close attention to the service as I should be, there's going to be someone who's going to notice that. Or if I'm being a little silly or goofy in the hall, you know, in the hallway between Sunday school and church, that's going to be noticed. So I certainly put a lot of pressure on myself, part of that being the oldest, mm-hmm. some of those types of things. But it was also neat to be, it was because of a small church, it really felt like this was just an extension of your family. I mean, it felt more like the people were like aunts and uncles and cousins more than, quote, parishioners at your church, right? It was a small Baptist church, 150, you know, total people. So it really had this really cool, unique feel to it. I got really involved. We had an Awana program there that I got really involved with and went through that program. And so just felt really blessed to have people who cared about our church, cared about each other. We did things together. We had it was much more than just a Sunday morning type atmosphere and feeling. And I think for me, really gave a really grounded part of this 360 experience of my home life being embedded in a Christian home life. My parents had us in a Christian school, so during the school day, I was getting a lot of really positive influence there. And then our church influence, it was a real, you know, important thing to us, and we got it. And again, I feel very blessed to have had that opportunity in my life to do that.
You know, you mentioned being the oldest child and feeling that pressure to perform. You know, I've joked with you about that before. I mean, you're a high performer. I mean, you're like you're the archetype of the oldest child. You crack me up. Would it give you anxiety if I challenged you to do something silly and embarrassing?
No, I do those kinds of things all the time.
I figured you'd answer like that. You'd be like, I'd be the best at it.
Now, here's what I usually would say to that. I say, I don't necessarily have to be the best, as long as I'm not the worst. Right. And but if it's somewhat competitive to it, I have no problem going for that. I've entered dance competitions when I have no business being in dance competition. But
well, that's good.
I'll have this. So I have an era. One of my strengths in the Strengths Finder world is self-assurance. Mm-hmm. And it's not that I think that I'm better than anybody else. It's just confidence in myself that I can figure it out.
Yeah,
and
so figure it out.
So if you have me do something silly, I've always loved trying new games or sports or activities, even though I knew I wasn't going to be good at it at first, but I would be confident that I could figure it out. So to do something silly, no problem at all. That would not prevent me from going all in and doing the best I could.
So you leave your home and you start your undergrad. Where was that at, and what did you study?
Yeah, good question. So after Portland, we moved to San Diego, California before my junior year of high school. So I finished my high school career there, and I started my college career at Grossmont Junior College in San Diego, mm-hmm. and earned my associate's degree there. And basically at that point, it was going through for those who don't know, California is a very strong community college, junior college system. Mm-hmm. It's very inexpensive, but also great academically. the classes automatically transferred to all of your four-level universities. So it was a great way to kind of get into college and have very low commitment financially. First semester of tuition, on a side note, was $50.
Really?
For a full-time course load, all of which transferred eventually to Indiana University, where I'll get to in a second. Mm-hmm. So by the time I left, I think it was $100 per semester. So basically your books cost more than tuition.
Wow.
Per semester. So again, very inexpensive. Played basketball at Grossmont College and had a great experience doing that. When I eventually transferred to Indiana University, and a quick side note on that was I was still trying to figure out what I wanted to do. So yes, but what I majored in. At Grossmont, it was an associate's degree and a general major. It was basically getting all your prereqs out of the way for right. whatever major you're going to get into. And when I went to, before I went to IU, I was actually kind of trying to figure out, okay, who am I? What am I good at? What does God want for me? What do I want for my life?
And did you have any tools to do that?
At the time, no.
It was just kind of
hoping
for the best.
I was, and again, yeah, I was hoping for the best. And I did not have any interest inventories or
right.
anything like that. But I was considering the military for one of those options. My dad had been in the military, knew people in the military, knew that was a potentially good option. And so literally the day I was going to sign my name, I'd gone through the process, taken the ASVAB, all this stuff, mm-hmm. got my physical. I was scheduled to go down and sign my name and my on the form to commit myself down that pathway. And my grandparents, who lived in Bloomington, Indiana, my dad's mom and dad, called me up that morning. I remember it clear as day, and said, Josh, have you signed your name yet? No. We would like you to consider about moving to Bloomington, live with us, and go to IU. And this was an option that had not been on the table at all at that point.
Really?
And thought about it, and literally that morning was what changed that trajectory. And again, not that the military was a bad option, certainly not. It was just it seemed like that was God stepping in saying, here's where I want you to go. Took me to Bloomington, Indiana, where I got to live with my grandparents. And because they were in Bloomington and we were on the West Coast, we saw them once every mm-hmm. year, maybe once every other year. So it was hard to have got to know them at a deeper level. And that was one of my most awesome experiences going to college, was living with my grandparents. As corny as that sounds, you know, about, you know, kids who go off and have this and the great college experiences. For me, it was, I got to have an awesome college experience at IU, but then at night I got to be with two people who were just amazing people who let me be me, mm-hmm. didn't try to be my parents, but at the same time offered me the support and the stability that allowed me to just focus on being a student at school. And
so you successfully navigated beer pong and all those kind of things, right?
Yeah. I was close. We were, if you're familiar with Bloomington, we lived right across the street from the football stadium.
No kidding. I know exactly where that is.
Yeah, on the bypass. We parked cars on our lawn on home games. And so you asked about the parties were off-campus parties were in many of these apartment complexes that were right there across the street from the football stadium. So I had many friends that mm-hmm. were walking distance to their home. So that's where, again, to my point, I got to experience college life, like in air quotes here, without, you know, I never lived in dorms. I didn't join a fraternity. I didn't do some of those traditional things, which was fine for me because I was pretty outgoing, pretty social. Mm-hmm. I didn't necessarily need those things to get engaged with other people right. and with the school.
It didn't need to be manufactured and
no.
alcohol fueled as much.
No, not at all. I got a job, started working, went to church with my grandparents. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I started making different social connections and
right.
that sort of thing.
So what was your favorite memory from college? Do you have a single one? Did you meet Bob Knight or Mark Cuban?
I had met Bob Knight several times. Yeah. In fact, I took, he was still there, had not got himself fired yet. And he, I took his basketball coaching classes mm-hmm. And worked his camp as well one summer. So he wouldn't know me or remember me. But I've met him several times and had some probably, so a quick Bob Knight story with that, a big memory. For those who don't know Bob Knight, pretty volatile basketball, longtime coach at IU.
His fans would say he's passionate, right?
He's passionate. He's passionate. So his passion, part of this advanced coaching class I got to take was we had to go to basketball practice and watch the practices. Now, the reason this is kind of unique is at IU, at that time, practices were closed.
Yes.
It was you could not, you were not allowed in the gym at Assembly Hall unless you had specific permission to be there. So this was a closed practices. So I got to be there and you would watch the entire practice. So as a young budding coach, you got to see how the practice was laid out, what points of emphasis were they working on. You know, I'd watched the game last week, you know who they're preparing for, and you got to see how all these things connect. And so to that point, there were several times where things happened in practice where, you know, Jason, I'd be like, and as a fellow coach, you'd be like, I can't believe I just saw that happen. Mm-hmm. There's anyone who's been around Bob Knight in the program has those stories. Sure. of just on and on. In my small little world that I was in a few practices. So one of these instances was, of course, we all know that Bob Knight is one of his – famous things that he did was against Purdue in the mid 80s. He didn't like a call and threw a chair across the floor of Assembly Hall that, you know, obviously got him ejected and becomes a very famous picture of him.
And then the AD have to come down and like nicely ask him, can you please leave now?
Yes.
I mean, it was kind of a,
it was not good. And as someone who was a Bob Knight fan at the time, not a fan of everything he did, obviously, but of his knowledge and wisdom of the game, I don't look at that as something that's like, oh, that's what I aspire to, is to be a chair thrower as a coach. So, but to that point, I was in practice, sitting maybe 20 rows up, sitting there quietly, which, you know, again, you don't want to do anything that's going to draw attention to yourself. One of maybe five people in the stands total in this whole Assembly Hall arena. And Knight got upset with the team about something. They'd made some mistakes, made some errors in these drills they were doing. And he picks up this folding chair and turns to throw it up into the stands. And as he's rotating to throw this chair up into the stands, he's rotating in my direction.
Oh boy.
And I'm sitting there and I'm like, what do I do? I mean, so this is all happening in a matter of seconds, right? Mm-hmm. He threw a chair and he released it and went flying up and lands maybe, I don't know, 10 seats away. I was in no jeopardy of being hit, but it's one of those memories where you're like, that was really crazy, right? I mean, yeah. to see someone actually, I was actually there and witnessed a chair being thrown as hard as he could up into the stands.
And thankfully you weren't on a smartphone.
I was, right? My gosh, no smartphones at that time.
Absolutely.
There were several other things like that had happened, but just great memories, individual memories like that, where I worked down there at a grocery store. I had great professors at IU and just lots of great memories and experiences at IU.
So I hope the statute of limitations is over with this, but I and a few friends snuck in and watched the practice. We had to lay down between the seats and
Peek
through the seats. And he was doing a layup drill, and he had a football handbag. And as guys drove and laid it up, he was absolutely hammering them.
And for people who don't know, Bob Knight was not a small guy.
He's a big man.
6'6", 250, 60, yeah. 70, probably easy.
And he's putting it on him. I mean, he's really whacking him. And he just laughed, and he said, welcome to the Big Ten. Welcome to the Big Ten, boys. Yeah. And I'm reluctant to share this, but I will because it's out there. Somebody put up on YouTube a recording of him, and it's called the Bob Knight Halftime Speech. So I have to give you some caveats. One is it's not safe for work. Yeah. Because of Bob Knight language.
Right.
I think it's interesting to listen to once because of, number one, it's so negative, and it's really not Bob in his best moment. And when I kind of wade through that and get to the other side of it, I process it as his will to win, his absolute competitive will must have been all-consuming. I mean, it must have creaked through his bones. And I have to wonder, is that required at that level? And it manifests differently with different coaches? Do they all have that same will to win, or do they have different wills? Is it the will to develop? Is it the will to develop their players? I don't know. I mean, what do those great coaches have that are just ultra elite? I mean, Florida State's baseball coach just retired.
Yeah.
An incredible winning record. I can't, like, I would love to crawl on their heads. What are your thoughts on that?
That's a great question. So I have had a chance to be around a few elite coaches during my days when I was coaching, and like you as well, I know as you coach as well, and you're coaching tremendous athletes, you end up having coaches come in to recruit your players or going to coaching camps and hearing or seeing these guys and gals talk. I would probably agree that their will to win is extremely high on a consistent basis. But also to what, and I'm just using your words, how they go about it, I think, is different.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a lot of great coaches from, you know, staying in the college basketball world, your Krzyzewskis and Tom Izzo's and people of those ilk. A lot of those players will tell you, if you've played for those guys, they'll tell you, yeah, those coaches have yelled at me. Mm-hmm. I've been called names, not personal names, but, you know, it's not always, can you please block out your man and get the rebound,
right?
There's expletives, there's you better do this or you're off, that, you know. But at the same time, they'll also tell you that a lot of players of those kind of coaches will tell you how much they know those coaches love them and care about them. And that, was something that Bob Knight struggled with, right? Or in his mind was not in how he was wired. People who've played for high-level coaches, whether it's the Florida State baseball coach or whoever it is out there, their players who have been through their programs will tell you, man, that coach cared about me and our program, and I know that they would do anything for us to help us not only as a team but as us individually. So I think it's that manifestation of how people use their individual talents and strengths to accomplish the goals and tasks that they have in front of them, that's what makes them all different, yet at the same time helps them be consistently successful in their given tasks.
Well, I really struggle with this as a coach. I'd say 50% of me can be Bob Knightish, upwards of 50%.
Sure.
And, you know, it doesn't always come out. It actually came out this week. I had a very nonchalant starting senior. Hey, why weren't, you know, I just asked. And we're in the locker room, guys standing around, why weren't you at practice yesterday? Mm-hmm. I overslept.
No.
And my Bob Knightometer went 0 to 1,000.
Yeah.
And the next phrase out of my mouth was, well, I guess it wasn't very important to you. And then I doubled down, and my volume went to about 120 decibels with a finger. And it was, you better get your blank buttoned up. And it was so, because I'm not like that hardly at all. I mean, the whole locker room was just really quiet, and we looked around. I was like, I don't know if I put enough into this kid's relationship account to do that.
Yeah.
And I felt really bad. And, you know, I went back to, a New Testament Bible search, and I just started looking at verses about, you know, your speech and your mouth and things. Mm-hmm. And I felt really convicted about it. So I'll probably talk to this guy next week. There's something inside me that says we don't have a lot of runway, we don't have a lot of time, and this is your senior year.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you're gonna remember this the rest of your life. And I have a lot of regrets in life, but one of the things I don't regret is the summer before my senior year of football in high school, I couldn't have worked any harder. There was nothing left, and, you know, we lost in the playoffs a couple rounds before state, and I remember walking off the field thinking, man, that team was really good. I don't think we could have done any better against him. Like, yeah. I don't have that, like, man, we could have, should have, would have, any of that stuff. And I have a couple favorite movies that kind of connect this sort of, this, like, real competitive fire and drive inside me that I have to wrangle. One is kind of the negative side of that. It's There Will Be Blood.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if, have you seen this
movie? Yes, I have. Yeah.
It's one of my favorites because Daniel Plainview's character is so intense on winning.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and for him, you have to lose for him to win.
Mm-hmm.
And he is so intense. I mean, the beginning of that movie is the most intense beginning to a movie I've ever seen. I mean, he blows himself up in a mine or something, breaks his leg. He has to crawl miles to get to the silver tent so he can stamp his claim. And, yeah. and I mean, and the ending is really sad. And if you know anything about Upton Sinclair, of course, he demonizes the two people he doesn't like, which are capitalists and preachers.
Yeah.
And they're both demonized pretty strongly in that.
Yep.
But the other one is more of a positive side, I guess, is Master and Commander.
Yes.
Yep. And Master and Commander is it's a historical drama.
Mm-hmm.
The Napoleonic Wars, the British mm-hmm. Navy fighting them, and the captain is being challenged by his best friend, who's also the ship doctor, mm-hmm. about how far is he willing to take this crew to hunt mm-hmm. down this French man of war. Mm-hmm. And he says a line that always stuck with me. He says, "I will grind whatever grist the mill requires."
Mm.
And that level of intensity to win is, there's something in me that I really have to rein it in.
Mm.
Because I want to work you harder. I want to work better. I want to know more. And I have some coaching friends that are like this, and I hope to get one on the podcast because I know he really wrestles with this too. And he just had a successful football season with leading arguably one of the most dominant defenses historically in Indiana. I mean, just an absolute throttle you to death, can't move the ball, can't pass the ball, you're not winning this game kind of a defense, just mm-hmm. right out of the gate. And it was impressive to watch. But that's because his master of details and his level of commitment to win. And we talk about this, like, you know, he's got a young son at home. He's, you know, he's been through the grinder of life. And mm. we talk about that, like, you know, what are you willing to lay on the table to be this good?
Yeah.
And so he's in a great situation where he's got a great support system around him. But anyway, all that said, as I approach my football season, you know, I have to pray about these things, and I
sure.
have to make sure my mind's right all the time. And I try to coach very much like a teacher.
Yeah.
So we break things down, we talk it through. And one of the things I do now that I didn't do as a young coach is I try to address the why.
Mm.
You know, why do we do this? Mm-hmm. Well, here's why you have to be in this stance.
Mm-hmm.
Here's what's actually happening upon the snap of the ball, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So you and I are part of the Blue Ring Club. Tell us about
yes.
your student teaching experience and the historic event you were part of.
Yeah. So I, of course, the final part of your teaching preparation experience at any university is going to be student teaching. And I was, again, blessed. I couldn't even tell you, it's a God thing. I was placed at Bloomington High School North to do my student teaching right there in Bloomington. So it was the high school close to us. I had no connections there. There was no reason to be placed there. I didn't know anybody. But I had played football, basketball, volleyball, and track in high school, and then had played basketball in junior college at back in San Diego, and then took these coaching classes for both football and basketball at IU while I was a student there. And so my goal at that point had been, I wanted to be a social studies teacher, and I wanted to coach football and basketball. I just thought, I had always loved social studies. It had been a subject area that I had a lot of interest and passion in. And just sports was something that was important to me. It was something I loved doing. I know how much it had positively contributed to my life and what it had allowed me to do, and wanted to kind of give back to that and impact other people that way. So as soon as I was placed there at Bloomington North, one of the first things I did was I sought out the head football and basketball coaches, just said, "Hey, look, I'm going to be student teaching here. Not looking to, if you have a place on your staff for me, I would love to be an assistant coach for you and do whatever you have right. available." Did football season and had a chance to then, which was great, had a great experience coaching football there. And then with basketball, again, total God thing. So this is my student teaching year, my first ever really coaching gig as an assistant. Officially, I was the freshman coach, but in the way that's the way they had the coach McKinney, the head coach at the time, had it set up, you were involved with everyone. So it wasn't just you did freshman and that was it. It was right. freshman, and then you're on the bench in the JV games. You're on the bench of the varsity games. Anytime the JV and varsity are practicing, that freshmen aren't, you're involved. You're scouting, mm-hmm. right? So you're part of this overall staff. It was definitely looked at as an entire staff. And the long and the short of it is, we had an outstanding basketball team that year. There was a group of seniors who had come up together, through middle school and into high school, who had stuck together and played in the summer and worked hard and and a small group of juniors who were high level contributors to their group. So out of our 7-8-man rotation, we had basically two juniors and the rest were seniors. The coach's son is the point guard. We've got the two juniors are eventual Indiana All-State players.
You can name drop. It's okay.
So the juniors that year, we've got Queth Dwaney, who goes on to play at Syracuse and win a national championship at Syracuse as the guard next to Carmelo Anthony in their system.
So he's okay if you're into that kind of thing.
If you're into winning and good basketball players.
He's decent.
He's pretty dang good. Jabril Conte was our center that year. He ends up going to Indiana State on a full ride and played professionally, internationally for 20 years after that. And just and he's back at Bloomington North now. And then we got these young men who were just they knew their role. And you talked about having the will to win. They all had this will to win. Like they all just every time we went into a game, they did not believe anyone was going to beat them, either one-on-one individually or as a group, no matter what. And nothing was going to get in their way. Even the coaches, there were times where they'd be like, they had that bond where it was like, guys, just forget what the coach is saying. We just got to come together and get this done and right. Do it. The coach's son is a senior point guard. We've got two twins, seniors, that are just these hard-nosed, dive on the floor, stick it in your gut, knock you down, grab a rebound, take a charge kind of players. Our shooting guard ends up being the center fielder at Butler on the baseball team and just an all-around athlete. Our first man off the bench is this point guard who is – by the way, this is 1996-97. He is still playing professionally in Malaysia as a point guard and is extremely fit and healthy. I mean, it was just – these guys just were committed to what they were all about. And that season was amazing. We end up, as you kind of hinted at, we end up winning the state championship in 1996-97. This is the last year of single-class basketball in Indiana. So everyone knew the following year there was going to be class basketball with four different classes. So it was that end of an era in basketball. Right. Indiana basketball had become was very well known for kind of that Hoosiers.
What are the big guy versus like? Little guy. What's the atmosphere like? I mean, you were in some of these big, big arenas that Indiana's known for.
It was interesting. They were intense. You know, we hadn't played in. So, and I certainly don't claim that I've been in every single gym, but our only loss of the year was at Anderson in the Wigwam. And yeah. So that's a, 9,000-plus seat arena. You've got it's huge. Mascots and lasers and smoke and people going
crazy.
And
people don't know, the Wigwam with 9,000 seats is just in the top 10.
Correct.
It's just in the top 10.
It's not the largest.
It's not the largest.
Yeah. We played at Newcastle the following year, which is the largest.
Yeah.
I think especially – it's interesting, especially when you get into the smaller towns. We were in southern Indiana. Mm-hmm. So when you get into Bedford, North Lawrence, and Jennings County, and places where
– Indiana, home of Damian Bailey.
Seymour. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. The high school, the local, your local high school basketball game was like your pro sports team, right? Mm-hmm. You don't have access to, going to a Colts game or a Pacers game. It's a long ways away. So this was important, and people were, it's on radio, it's on TV, it's a lot of, there's local sports newspaper writers for the high school team that are covering the team. It's a big deal.
And kids weren't hopping schools then?
No.
This was kids that the community saw grow up.
Yes.
They saw them in Little League. They saw them in T-ball.
Yeah.
And they saw them in their youth basketball, park and rec stuff. And they knew that, oh, man, this group's going to be really good when they're 17.
I think so. And was also really special about this group, too, which I take a lot of – I'm glad to have been a part of, was they were diverse racially and economically. You had kids who had come from – subsidized housing or from the family housing at IU, their parents are going to school or professors there. You had kids who came out of homes who had, upper middle class backgrounds. You had country kids from the country. We have two kids whose, two of those kids, their parents were from Africa. Mm-hmm. So they're first generation, American citizens.
Right.
And so it was, we had this really cool, diverse United Nations kind of approach of who these young men were on our team.
So you're telling me their school and their sport, the sport they love, brought people together? That's fascinating. How does that work?
How does that work? Exactly.
Didn't you have somebody on your freshman team?
That year we had, yeah. We were loaded behind that year too. So we had, so Jared Jeffries was a freshman that year. Let's see. So he was, I'd coached him in AAU the summer before, 6'6", athletic. You know, eventually he grows to be 6'10", and, you know, plays at IU, plays 10 years in the NBA. But we were so good that even at 6'6", as a freshman and a good basketball player, he wouldn't have had a spot on the varsity, quite honestly. He was a JV player for us.
How many schools is that kid playing varsity right out of the gate?
Oh,
I mean, most probably.
95% he would have been. There'd been very, very few. Behind him is another player, Scott May, Sean May.
Yeah.
Scott May's son, Scott May, a famous IU player, and Sean May, who goes on to play at North Carolina and play in the NBA. And so we had this, all this talent right there.
So that's
and
your scout team.
That's the scout team, yeah, yeah. And just, you know, what a year. What a year of tremendous games, individual games, experiences. Great kids. We had a great coaching staff, and you know, I know you experienced things like this as well with your state championships. But just one of my favorite memories after we'd won the state championship, we played at the RCA Dome. 34,000 people were there. We get the Indiana State Police give us a escort from Indianapolis all the way back to Bloomington in our bus, lights on and everything. Mm-hmm. We roll back in at I don't know 1 a.m. and our gym is packed. Just people. We have an impromptu pep rally there at 1 a.m. to celebrate the state championship. And that's a very cool memory in my mind. We have a big, huge, you know, picture in the gym that I look forward to taking my kids back to and, you know, point out, there's your dad from a long time ago. And just an amazing experience. I can't even say enough how blessed I felt to be a part of that.
It had to have been hard to even want to coach basketball after that. Like, this is so historic and unusual that
I tell people jokingly, like, I knew it was special, but it felt easy. And I hate to even use that word. I heard,
I know what you're saying. Good programs that are set up well.
Yeah.
Can feel like that.
It can't. And so it's my first year, right?
Hitting all cylinders.
I hadn't gone through a 25-year struggle of building a program, of moving up through the ranks of coaching at that point. It was, you're dropped in as an assistant at Golden State, right, in your first year. And now, oh, wow, this is really easy when you have all these players, you know, or you're an assistant at New England Patriots or something.
Yeah, it's like the player that
this is really
2
easy.
Years played at Golden State, won championships, and then got traded to Toronto, won another one.
Like, yeah, there you
three
go.
3 years in the league, he's got 3 giant rings.
He's on his way.
This must be normal.
Yeah, this is normal, right? That's how it is. Of course, that's not how it is, it was an amazing, amazing experience. I had great coaches to see Jared Jeffries then step in and move up through the ranks and do what he did to see Sean May come in. It's a different level of expectations and competition. Again, when you see those kids who have Division I talent, mm-hmm. and are also working hard enough to be Division I legitimately.
Yeah.
Sean May came in and he needed to get leaner as a freshman. He'd go to practice and then we'd take him in the pool and swim. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's a 6'6", 6'7", freshman basketball player, you know, and he didn't complain. He's like, nope, this is what I got to do. And he may have been complaining in his mind at times, but he knew that's what he had to do. And that was those types of things to help that helped us, you know, be consistently very good.
And there's a little more of a culture now of like, man, skip this. I'm just going to go to another school, or they're just going to let me start right away, and you know,
yeah,
things like that. And how do you think coaches that are leading high school programs curb that? They get kids to buy in and double down and stick around, because the thing that I've seen, at least in the football world, is no matter how good the program is, if a kid has to wait till they're a junior or senior to play, they're bailing out.
They're going, yeah. So, and that's an unfortunate world that we live in, because I don't think it's good for kids. I don't think it's good for athletic programs that's the case, because there's growth in having to earn your spot. There's growth and nothing being given to you. I'm a good freshman or sophomore. Well, so what? You have to go earn it. Or if you've got a D1 kid in front of you who's a year or two ahead of you, we'll learn from them.
Right.
Change positions or something, right? So people get locked into, well, you know, well, I'm the wide receiver, I'm the running back, I'm a quarterback. Well, are you? I mean, I don't know. I think for coaches, for great coaches do, especially the high school level, is, right, as you create that, it's that culture of more than just what happens on the field. It's the idea that you're going to grow as a person and as a young man, a young woman, if it's a women's program, as a young person because of being a part of this program. And there's more to it than just what you get out of it on the court. At high school, I think there's so many opportunities for coaches. I see so many great lessons that coaches talk about pouring into kids who maybe moms and dads aren't around as much as they can or should be, or there's different health situations or financial situations, and coaches are pouring into these kids beyond just the sports part of it, helping. We both saw the video recently of the coach teaching their players how to change a tire, mm-hmm. right? Just making sure that they have some basic life skills because, right, not all of them have a mom or dad at home that can teach them those things.
Right.
And just saying, you know what, you're getting life skills that you may not remember how to, you know, how do I tackle it? You know, how do I take on the two technique on this certain play? But you know what, I remember how to change a dang tire so that if that ever happens to me, I'm ready to go. Or how to treat each other, or how to work through struggles. I mean, these are things that I think in our society, and talking about school hopping, it's going to be too hard for me to break in, so I'm going to take a path of least resistance and go somewhere else. And I think that's an unfortunate lesson that those kids are being taught at a younger age, that just because there's a challenge in front of you, instead of buckling down and figuring out how do I earn my spot, how do I earn my opportunity to play? It's, well, instead of working through that, I'm just going to go somewhere else where that spot will be given to me. And that's a sad lesson, I believe.
Yeah, I believe in truth and love. And when you're investing in kids, sometimes you have to tell them the truth.
Oh, yeah.
That, just like you said, that you could transfer. You could go to this other program, and they're probably telling you all kinds of things that may or may not be true, and, you know, recruiting you and things like that. However, you will not have grown as a person that has had to really work for your job, you know, really had to go through that process. Mm-hmm. And you will be weaker mm-hmm. when you go to whatever D1 college or whatever mm-hmm. you think you're doing after high school. Mm-hmm. And I've had a few of those conversations, and I did have a couple guys that didn't listen, and then they came back and were like, well, you're right. I had a few guys that transferred and found out they weren't going to play there either,
mm-hmm.
you know. And you know, that my evaluation was honest. I mean, you know, and that's a unique conversation for kids. They don't always hear, hey man, I love you, and I'm gonna tell you something you're not gonna wanna hear.
Yeah.
And you know, they don't have a lot of people in their lives. A lot of kids don't have people in their lives that do that. So you're a young teacher. So let's take you to young teaching Joshua.
Yes.
And we could talk all day about, you know, great educator preparation programs, and that's kind of the world you're in, that I'm in a little bit. But what were some things that, not intentionally or not, you know, not because the program that you're in wasn't good, but just were some things that you walked into a classroom and were like, whoa, I wasn't fully prepared for this.
Yeah.
A little bit of shock and awe.
So, I thought IU had a great teacher prep program. It's still a really great teacher preparation program there, like many universities have. I think some things to your question. One is, again, I was blessed to have great mentor teachers. So I felt like I was, some people in their student teaching experiences, it's almost like, here's the keys to the classroom, good luck.
Right.
And there's
right.
kind of that, I'll be back in 6 weeks when you're done kind of thing. For mine, it was, we developed relationship with the mentor teachers. We were assisting them initially, and then, you know, we got to know the kids, the routines, the classroom, learning, and then occasionally stepping in. So it's kind of that, I think it's that that great model of what these mentor teachers did for us was, you know, I do and you watch. In other words, I watch, mm-hmm. they did it, I watched, and then it was I do and they assist, right? And mm-hmm. then it was, and then it eventually transitioned to where I'm in the full lead. And it was very much this nurturing, very nurturing, supportive atmosphere. So probably to answer your question, one of the things that I really felt that I didn't truly understand was the importance of, understanding how learning actually happens. The importance of that each kid is this unique individual person, that your classroom really needs to be student-centered. Mm-hmm. If it's not about students, then really you're showing up for yourself and you're showing up for the adults, and that's highly ineffective in the learning process.
And it's easy to do because a lot of school is structured for the adults.
It is. Yeah. Most parts of school are structured for adults. We know what the right things to do are, but then when you start thinking about, well, why can't we change, start talking about student school start times, right?
Right.
There's science supporting what times younger kids and older kids should be starting schools, but what happens? You get what messes up this schedule and this contract and this, and all of a sudden it's like, it's not convenient for the parents, not convenient for the school board doesn't like it.
Right.
We just won't do it. So the other piece too that I also learned early on was the importance of continual learning about your pedagogy and mm-hmm. about instructional practice. I think that idea that as educators, there's always new and important things that we can and should be learning about just how learning happens and learning processes. And we use the term brain-based learning back when I was actually in the classroom. The idea of how is that actually occurring? What do we need to be doing as far as taking what we did previously and scaffolding and building upon that to really maximize our learning curve to help our students move forward? The idea of mastery learning, I think, has come a long way. The idea of mm-hmm. Initially that was, when we first started, it was, well, I taught it and then I gave a test on it and now we're moving on. And now this concept, the idea of, well, wait a minute, what if they didn't learn it?
Right.
I taught it. That's a very teacher or adult-centered approach, right? I did it. You didn't get it, so that's your fault, and now I'm moving on. Student-centered says, I taught it. Did you learn it? You didn't learn it? Well, what do we need to do to help you make sure that you've learned it, right? We're going to make sure that you've mastered that content, that skill set, before you move on. And that's a real challenge. You're in the classroom right now. It's easy for me to say that. It's way harder to do. And that's what I think it's a way that master teachers do, because you've got 32, 34, 36 kids showing up every class period, 5, 6, 7 class periods a day, and you got to try and figure out how to get them all moving in these directions. But what great teachers do is they're constantly working to figure out, how do I do this through technology and through cooperative learning structures and through remedial things and responses to intervention that I can do to help these students get what they need so they don't fall behind, they don't fall through the cracks, and that they're going to be prepared to move on in life and into the next level of schooling because of their experience with me as a teacher. Those are some things that I remember very vividly learning during my experience.
Did you ever have a bad day? Did you ever have that day that was like so bad that you were like, oh, I don't know if I'm equipped. I know you're really high on self-assurance, so for you a bad day is probably like, well, we're going to do this better tomorrow.
Did
you ever have, and I'm curious just to know how you kind of pulled out of the nosedive. You ever had a bad week that was just like, man, kids, I am not firing with kids. Kids are not meshing with me. We are grinding gears here.
Yeah, I think, as I reflect on that, it was probably more on times when, with students, I was always about hitting that reset button whenever I needed to hit it. It's like, okay, we're obviously not where we need to be, right? I thought we were moving down this way and this path, and whoops, we're not on the same path right now.
So it's kind of like coach reset. Just blowing the whistle and stopping practice and be like, hold on, we're obviously not on the same page here.
Yes.
Yeah.
When things that didn't go well, or things that I have a less than positive reflection on, it'd be things such as I had an early principal who was not well regarded or well respected at all by teachers or students, and she wrote me up for missing hall duty, and she'd walked right past me and just didn't say hi to me. And I was, and so I remember being in her office being, so this was like one time. I wasn't in the hall, according to her. And I was like, no, no, you walked right past me.
You heard it here, folks. You heard it here first.
I was there.
Joshua got written up once.
I did.
Did you ever get detention in high school? I'm curious.
Were
you ever that kid?
I probably talked my way out of it.
Did you sit up and smile your way out of it?
I was kind of a Ferris. I could do some Ferris Bueller.
I wondered if you had some Ferris Bueller
in
you.
I had some Ferris Bueller in me, yes.
A little finesse.
Yes.
Okay, I'm sorry. So you're sitting in the office. You're being written up.
Been written up.
New experience for you.
Yeah, and I think what I learned from that is again, you know, it's like your first professional job, right? I mean, every other job you've had prior to that has been more of an hourly
employee.
This is kind
of devastating. Like,
I'm like,
what are we doing here?
What are we doing? Like, okay, this is going on my record. What's going to happen? And I was like, you know, does this mean I'm going to get fired? I mean, what's going to happen? So
did you sign it Daffy Duck? Like,
no, I didn't go that extent. I did sign it in crayon. No, I'm kidding. I didn't do that. But, yeah, it was a learning experience. It was about, okay, so I need to fit, you know, how do I play the game in some situations where, in this case, where he had poor leadership. Mm-hmm. So how do I need to navigate that? And
how
so
do you lead up?
And how do you lead up? And how do you protect yourself at a young age and as a young professional? And luckily, I went on to take another position at another school a couple years later, and I had a principal who was absolutely amazing, just retired this current year. Mm-hmm. And I went from having a principal who I thought, man, I don't know if there could be someone worse than what's happening here, to one who I thought, man, if I could be half as good as him someday, that would be amazing. And so it was during my student teaching year that my mentor teacher, again, said, Josh, you need to go back to school and get your master's degree and become an administrator. And I was like, no, 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 I want to be a teacher and a coach. He's like, no, that's fine. You be a teacher and a coach, but just go get your master's degree now so that you've got it in your back pocket because you're going to be an administrator someday.
That's tremendous.
And she was that pivot point for me that planted that seed and gave me the confidence to say, oh. And going from those, I tell those principal stories because seeing the one I did not have a lot of respect for really challenged me to say, oh, I know I can do it better than that. And then just have a really good one to say, oh, he's setting a high bar. Man, if I can be half as good as him, I think I could be pretty effective as an administrator.
And I think that's a great lesson for anybody leading is when you see, you know, people that have the character and capacity for a leadership role that you have, you know, not to be afraid of losing that person, but to encourage them to get the training, get what's required, you know, move, you know, pivot in that direction because it's what's best for them, you know, ultimately, you know, to have you in the career and now, which we'll get to in a little bit, is it has a much bigger impact and service to other people than what your role would have been, you know, probably in the classroom, which would have had a tremendous impact for all those kids over the years, for sure. But you wouldn't have been able to affect and influence leaders of schools. So
well, that was the main reason I even looked at moving from teaching to administration in the first place was I felt that my scope, my sphere of influence, kind of that Per of Jabez kind of approach, that idea of, you know, give me a broader scope of ability to impact other people. I felt like, yes, I know I'm impacting my students positively, but I felt like I could be impacting teachers and the entire school organization and obviously students by going into administration. And I tell people now, looking back, I feel like I was probably a slightly above average teacher, and I don't know how great I could have become. I think I could have become pretty good if, you know, continuing to hone my craft. My wife is an outstanding teacher and has a high level grasp of the teaching process. She's as close to a master teacher as I've seen. I'm like, I don't know if I could have been as good as her in the classroom, but I think that I am wired to be a pretty good administrator. I'm not trying to say that I'm great or that, but the idea is that I think that I'm wired. I think my strengths and things that I'm interested in and have a passion for, in the areas of leadership and organizational leadership and growing and improving and having this bigger impact. That's how I'm wired to think about things, and that's where I feel like I've been able to, been blessed to have opportunities to do that in leadership through throughout K-12 education. So,
and that's, those are some unique skills too, to understand all perspectives through problems, and to understand long-term impact through problems.
Yeah.
Sometimes a short-term answer creates long-term problems.
Yes, and that would be some of my early lessons for administration.
Yeah.
So, you know, my first AP gig at a high school, I'm 29 years old, I get the gig, and you know, so obviously most of my staff on average are older than me, and now I'm in a supervisory role, my coaching staff, and I'm also an athletic director for the building. So
yeah, so you're the 29-year-old assistant principal now. Yeah. That has to review teachers that have done this for 30 years. Like,
oh, yeah.
Come on in, Sonny. Let
yes.
me tell you how this is done.
I'm doing teacher evaluations. I'm reviewing how they've handled discipline.
Are you handling discipline yourself? Are you the discipline guy?
Oh, yeah. We had discipline. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's the assistant principal track, isn't
it? Oh, yeah.
You get to go through that grind.
Yes.
Good times.
Good times indeed.
Did you have any crazy days as an assistant principal?
Oh,
any,
goodness. Yeah. There's as an assistant principal, and this is still true, I know today, is first off, when you're in administration, it's your, especially as an assistant, your leadership's, as much as you want to be proactive with leadership, you're almost driven by reactive, right? I can have a plan for what I want to get done today, but
you're putting out fires.
As soon as that first referral walks through the door, student walks, I mean, it's like you're on, especially if it's something big like, you know, unfortunately, if there's drugs or weapons, you know, that's going to take your entire day is done at that point because of investigation,
sure.
follow-up and communication, it's done. So some crazy things that happened, you know, from that standpoint. We had a student, who ran out of who fled school, and the officer is chasing him, and this student like intentionally tried to swim across a swamp.
Oh my gosh.
And got about 30 yards in and realized he wasn't going to make it. And I had to turn around and come back. And we were all just, it was one of those where he was like, dude, if you start to go down and one of us has to go in and get you, we're going to up the discipline here. Just swim back, you know? Yeah. And,
this is an escape from Alcatraz.
It's not escape from Alcatraz.
Where's your raft?
Yeah. We had the student who came to us and said, I want you guys to suspend that kid. He sold me bad weed.
Oh,
like, what
gosh.
Do you mean? He says, well, he told me it was weed, and he sold me, it's oregano. So we're like, okay, so, I was like, huh, what do we do with this, right? Like, what do you do with that, right? Where it's like, the kid tried to buy drugs, but was unsuccessful because he purchased fake drugs. All right, so it's that type of thing.
Right. A little buyer beware.
Buyer beware. Right? We're like, what do we do with this?
And would you say that, and I know these are some examples you're giving, but in that assistant principal position, you're talking to kids and having just what would seem in normal professions odd conversations with people, just like, no, you can't do this.
Yeah.
This is, you can't do that.
And well, so here's what I've always said about in my time with working with students more directly is I always felt like kids were the easy part.
Sure.
Kids, I always say adults were the hardest part of K-12. And when I say adults, anyone who's an adult, so a teacher, a parent, an administrator, a school board member, a media person, that we know we, I, of course, as an adult myself, we complicate the thing, right? So kids, I often, when you get them alone and one-on-one, there was not the ego, there's not the emotion, and you're talking through it, I find kids
are not in front of their friends.
They're not in front of their friends. Yeah. They're not probably puffed up and give some tough guy or
right.
tough gal answer. They're like, yeah, I know. It was pretty dumb. I mean, I was mad. He looked at my girlfriend and said something, and I shouldn't have done it. You know,
right.
Outside of that, they're like, man, you know, it's talking a big game. It's
oh,
all
yeah.
this. And then the parents come in and want to defend it and all this kind of stuff.
And phones have absolutely amplified this.
And phones have amplified it, yes.
Because one of kids' favorite things is recording
yes.
fights.
Oh, yes. And stirring the pot.
Oh, absolutely.
So I think I always thought, you know what, my goal here is, as an assistant principal, is obviously you have to enforce the rules and hold people accountable. But ultimately with kids, it's about changing behavior. Right? That's the main thing we're trying to do here. I made bad decisions. I had poor behavior. I was skipping class. I was getting into arguments, whatever. We're trying to make sure that doesn't happen anymore, right? We want positive behavior to help. And so that's where I always try to look at things to say, okay, what is in the best interest of this kid to help us change behavior so that this kid can adjust their track to go where they need to go. So it's not just here's your detention slip because you were in the hallway when you shouldn't have. It's, let's talk about why, what are you doing? What's going on?
Because changing behavior means you have to change thinking, and that's really hard.
It is.
Because adults are funny, you know, we expect kids to change behavior, but I'm always like, when was the last time you did something different? When was the last time you changed your mind about something?
Exactly.
Right? I mean, we're so bad at it.
And of course we get locked in, like we think because we're adults, right? As we've locked in our way of thinking about things.
I've gotten to the place in life with kids that I ask lots of questions, and the things that come out of their mouth begin to educate them.
Yes.
So you were mad because, so, and you said what, and, you know, and it's just funny conversations.
Well, and that's a great, and I'm going to use the term coaching technique, mm-hmm. but not from an athletic coach, but from as you're trying to help someone grow and understand as an individual, you learn, and this is something I know you're really good at, Jason, is just asking really good questions, right?
Thank you.
It's that you're not trying to tell them the answer for their problem, right? You're trying to ask the right questions to help them understand how they got themselves into their own problem and how they can
understand. I love leading with that. Help me understand, because I'm not in your world. So what's going on?
Little Dr. Phil, right? Yes. Little, like, how's that working for you?
I wish I could throw a little Texan drawl into it.
There we go.
So you're a young administrator. You've been through the teaching grind and all that. Education is one of those careers where you're continually pouring out. You're pouring out, and you feel passionate about your kids and your people you serve, and you want to do the best for them. And it's really easy to get off track with taking care of yourself.
Yeah.
What do you think of that? And you see teachers going through this, I got a chance to meet Amber with the Burned In Teacher podcast, she's doing great work there. But it's a profession that, in my opinion, is similar on its effects in the home as being a police officer, a firefighter, trauma nurse, anything that's like part you're the ambulance at the bottom of the cliff, and part therapist, priest. And what are your thoughts on that?
So it's at this point in my career, it's extremely easy for me to look back and see where I was. I spent way too much time on the, and it sounds bad to say the outpouring part, but the idea is I was out of balance. I did not have a balanced life. My goal at that time was, and it wasn't, I don't believe that it was selfishly motivated. I'm not climbing the career ladder to please myself. It was just my own ideas and perceptions of the job was, I'm going to give everything I can at work. Literally, this was my daily routine, Jason. My average day was when I was a high school principal, it was about a 14-hour day, 12 to 14-hour day, and really not unlike it when I was teaching and coaching, but just a different type of intensity and pressure and things that were on. And then I would go, I would work until I was literally too mentally or physically tired to work anymore. Then I would go home.
And you're experiencing decision fatigue. Like if I have to make one more decision.
Yeah. I'm out of gas.
Yeah, I'm totally out of gas on this.
And to your point about, I certainly can't speak to what other professions go through, but there's things that would happen with horrible things have been threatened way more than one time at school by people threatening attorneys or students threatening violence or whatever. And so now I have to go home to my spouse at the time and have young kids and carry this weight of like, okay, what do I share and not share? Like, I don't want to freak her out about these things. I'm not exercising. I'm not eating right. Because I gave everything was to the job. I was trying to advocate for my job, advocate for our school, be a leader, help every person I could. But I was not finding the balance that I needed. And ultimately, it cost me. It cost me in my marriage. And I thought at the time that I was being a good husband because I was being a provider.
Right.
And that was in my mindset at the time was, this is what a good husband does. I provide, I make a good living, I bring home a good salary, and we're not struggling for food or a place to eat, to live.
And but I would say that young men have to be coached through that.
Because yes.
Young men are absolutely 100% wired for that.
Yes.
Like, well, I'm doing my job.
Yeah.
We got direct deposit.
Exactly. And you're exactly right. And that's something that I would, one of my things that I try and pour back out into to young men as well, and young dads and newly married young men, is, you know, there's an aspect of that where obviously providing is an important part, mm-hmm. but, you know, I stopped courting my wife. I stopped giving and being intentional about my time at home, about being intentional about my time as a dad with young boys, mm-hmm. because I had nothing left to give. I literally, my mind was done when I got home at that time. And so one of my, you know, life lessons that I learned was, and I've really strived to make sure, is the idea of life of balance of, mm-hmm. do I have time? Am I creating time for my spiritual life, my physical, taking care of myself, making sure I have time to spend with my wife and family on a regular basis, mm-hmm. not just when I, and then taking the job for what it is. I'm going to give everything I have to it. But then setting a limit to that. It's not work till I get too tired to go on anymore. It's, I have parameters for that. And I need to have energy and time to dedicate to my family. Because one of the things I tell people too, is especially young men, is, you know, if something happens to me tomorrow, my current employer, and I pass away, my current employer, the only thing that's going to go faster than my obituary is the help wanted sign that's going to find my replacement, right? I mean,
yeah, absolutely.
Life goes on for organizations, right? So whether it was when I was a principal or in my role now, life's going to go on. And we have to put that in context to what are we making more important than our families and our relationships with God and things like that. And at that time, I had my job was way ahead and had everything.
Right.
And it cost me.
Yeah. You know, I appreciate you sharing that because, there's a lot of, redemption in just sharing the L's.
Yeah.
You know, I've been through that grind too. And you're absolutely right. For me, I had a lot of pride. I thought mm-hmm. that I was so vital, you know, to this deal, you know, grinding through. And I was so passionate about these kids, you know, I am leading an alternative school or just being in the situations where your kids are literally dying and not in a teenage girl kind of way, literally mm-hmm. actually dying. If you're not pulling them off streets and you're helping them and you feel so passionate about it and you're pouring it and you got nothing in the tank. And if you don't set parameters up, it can be even part of your job negotiation. Like, here's the mm-hmm. things I will not do, mm-hmm. and these are not going to be part of my job, mm-hmm. and these are the hours I'm going to work, and these are the decisions I'll make, and these are the ones that are above my pay grade, and that's part of that, you know, defensive, you know, the home, things that I think young men aren't, we're just not taught those things.
Well, you hit one of the two key words that I use a lot to describe my failures at that time, pride and selfishness. My aspect of pride was I was too prideful to admit that my relationship at home was not where it needed to be and to seek help. So people at the time would tell us that we looked like the all-American couple, sure. air quotes. The thing, we smiled, we went to church and blah, blah, blah.
Got the cul-de-sac life.
Yeah. But the reality was it was strained. It was hard. It was not as loving as it needed to be and should have been. The other part of that was the selfishness part. And the selfishness was the idea of I'm doing what I need to do for my job, mm-hmm. but I wasn't doing what I need to do for the people that I've made commitments to. And that's to my wife and to my, those, you know, and to God. I've made commitments to God and commitments to my wife and as a dad that I was putting, even though, again, I'm not selfishly saying I'm not going out trying to make one more sale or
right.
to generate more money per se. It's about my perception of me doing a good job at my
sure.
work.
And you have high
career.
Standards for yourself. There's yeah. a standard to the job that you think you have that you've seen other people do well, but you have no backstory on. Sometimes we look up at people and we think, man, they're just killing it. And they're also 20, 25 years older. They're empty nesters. They don't yeah. like, they don't have these things at home. They got maybe a really supportive spouse and it's mm-hmm. just the two of them and they're mm-hmm. killing it. And they're in that prime golden bandwidth.
Mm-hmm.
They're in the power curve of their transmission.
That's right.
You know? So you're on the other side of that.
Yeah.
You've taken the L. You're figuring out I've got this new world of fathering my boys that I don't get to see all the time.
Yeah.
And that's and for parents that aren't with their kids all the time, that is a whole new world.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of things that creep in, right? Shame, regret, yeah, all those emotions. Now you're trying to be a good dad. You're trying to manage all that and how you feel. How did you pull out of that nosedive? Were there people in your mm-hmm. life? Was there a new church? Was there and certainly you probably felt like you had to get out of that community. I mean, you were a public figurehead in that community, and you just took a big L.
And lived in that community too.
And lived there. Yeah.
So
you're
in. Yeah, I took it on the chin.
This is grocery stores.
Public.
This is T-ball practice. Yep. This is everything.
Everything. Mm-hmm. That was rough. And kind of, you know, some of the more specific aspects of the ultimate demise of our marriage was also somewhat public. So it was, you know, and things that certainly I'm not proud of how, you know, I conducted myself mm-hmm. as a man, and as a man who's, you know, committed myself to Christ, I was not following Christ's,
But I thought Christians were perfect.
No, not at all. Not at all.
They don't go to church because they don't want to be those perfect people.
You know what? I was never a judgmental person, but if anything, I've gone through this. My empathy level, which I'm not a naturally empathetic person, has gone way up.
Yeah.
Because to your point to that, when I going through this process, it's like, I took it on the chin for a while, and deservedly so, mm-hmm. but to move on past it, you start to see a lot when things happen for other people or people make bad decisions or whatever. It's not an excuse to say, but it's to say, you know what? Hey, you went through a bad patch. You had made some bad decisions. Now let's pick how we can pick ourselves up and keep moving forward. Not necessarily, you know, judge or ostracize. The struggle there too. Yes, to back to your question, I was again. God put some amazing people in my life that just. Some people just like literally had a guy who saw it on my face.
Mm-hmm.
That's literally how he approached with me. He says, Josh, I don't know what's going on with you, but there's something. Your face is just different right now, that you've got something going on. Do you want to talk? He was a blue collar guy who worked in factories. So mm-hmm. he's not some professional psychologist or whatever. He's
right.
a guy like God put it on his heart to literally ask me that question. And we ended up meeting for breakfast once a week for the next year. My dad, when I kind of poured out to my dad everything that had happened, he stepped in and really became kind of my coach and mentor on a regular basis. Because what I also learned at that time is when going through that, I really did step back and like, okay, what are things in my life that I've allowed to creep in that are stealing my joy,
sure.
that are distractions from what I – and so you start to peel away, what do I not need to be doing right now? And you start peeling stuff away and saying, okay, what is most important? And you start to focus, you have to like refocus down to, mm-hmm. okay, if God hasn't been as important as he needs to be, what does that need to look like now? My family in this changing dynamic, what's that need to look like? And how do we redefine that? And literally it's like reprioritizing your things down to like one hand. Like if you go beyond five things on your hand at that point, you're not at a point where you can adjust as you need to adjust. I ended up meeting after my divorce. I ended up meeting my now wife. We had a mutual friend who introduced us, and you know, my wife Holly has been just a tremendous blessing to me. One of the things that we did, we're both in second marriages. From the very beginning, we just poured out. Here's who we are. You know,
right.
There's no games. Here's the things I think I'm really good at and things I'm proud of in life. Here's some things I'm not so proud of, but I want to make sure you know are there. It's the realities. But here's what I've learned from them, and here are the things, the steps I've done to help overcome them. And that was something that she really appreciated, the idea that my self-awareness, having gone through this, a lot of reading and reflection and pouring out and really kind of trying to do a reset on some things was – she didn't expect me to be perfect, just like you just said. We're not perfect, but can we at least identify where we've got some struggles, and then talk about and identify how we're gonna deal with that,
mm-hmm.
and work with it together. Just be genuine, and be real, and as Brené Brown would say, be vulnerable. And that's where trust is built from, and relationships come from. And that's really how I've tried to reset as a second, now my second round of marriage, if you will, and as a dad who is not living with his boys on a daily basis, is every time I see them, I have to maximize that time. How can I try to pour into them as much as I can, but not in a beat you over the head. Here's 2 weeks of
I've
learning.
Asked you about that before. I mean, like, your social media is like, I'm like, man, hey, dial it down. You're killing me.
Like, no, hardly. No, man.
I feel like I need to, you know, fly my kids to Disney every weekend. I totally get it. And, you know, on a side note, you know, when we first met, I was like, you know what? I really like this guy. I'm going to make him my friend. I just basically, like, headlocked you. And, you know, it's like, all right, hey, let's go out. We're going to go out and do stuff. Yeah. Let's go do lunch. And you know, and I appreciated you sharing with me some of those things. And I always thought, man, it'd be great for him to share that story with a few more people because people go through that. You know, was there a point where you had to really wrestle with the idea of returning to God? Not that you left, but just that, okay, God and I have to have this conversation.
Yeah.
And that's not always fun.
So the hardest part for me was in that process, and my dad had to really, like, drag me through this, was the topic of forgiveness for myself. So you're talking about shame and regret and those types of things. It was, yes, God, I know that you forgive me for and you died on the cross and your son died on the cross for my sins, and he's already paid the debt for all these things, but, you know, Satan really, I mean, takes advantage of those things. I think he likes to regret and shame, especially for men, I think, are just such powerful tools that he tries to use to hold us back from realizing our true potential in Christ, because I think he wants to plant this seed of, how can you even think about doing great things when you've done all that?
And the accuser.
The accuser
shows up and tries to minimize you, and walk you back from your dreams and your potential, and a real, like, generous blessing relationship with God. And that's, and I see that a lot. And I see folks that are, you know, I always call it the grinder. People go through the grinder of life and they retract from God because it's that shame talk in their head.
Yes.
And when really God loves them and wants to bless them, it's like, you have this kingdom at work that could heal you, bless you, take you all kinds of new places, and it's right there. And, you know, one thing that I always want people to know is you're one small step from just going back to God. No matter how far you've gone, how much shame you think you have, there is an accuser in your mind that wants you to play it small, that wants you to stay away from your word. God wants to talk to you and just read that word. And get the people around you but I see a lot of men, especially. I mean, I have dear good friends that, you know, were on fire for Christ and have, you know, been through tough stuff like that and just have doubled down on addiction and, you know, I don't want to be at church with all those hypocrites. They've been hurt by people and things like that. And, and so I want to encourage them as much as possible. And it sounds like, thankfully, you had enough of an internal theological DNA in your upbringing. You had people around you, you know, your father that were like, look, I'm gonna drag you through this, kicking and screaming, and when it could have been easy to throw in the towel.
Yeah, it could have been. Yeah, it was. My DNA was such that it was interesting. Even at the time, even before the divorce was finalized, I was trying to, you know, gain redemption with my ex-wife and trying to paint this picture of, man, wouldn't this be great if we utilized this struggle and these things that happened to us for good and for help other people. And I certainly don't blame her for not wanting to pursue that vision at the time. But the idea was that I know that God has there's an opportunity to do something to help other people in this world, to learn from or take from what I've experienced and help other people. And I can only hope that I can be that person that, you know, that guy who noticed me and said, man, are you, you know, there's something different, man. Are you all right? the person who was willing to pour into me, the person who didn't judge me, the person who the church that asked me to take on new leadership roles, knowing that, yeah, here's my past. I'm just making sure you know, because none of us are perfect. And, you know, Satan wants to hold us back, like you said. Satan wants us to believe that we're not worthy. We don't deserve, like the self-limiting beliefs, right?
Yeah.
You don't deserve a happy marriage. You don't deserve to be happy or successful, or you don't deserve to have a great relationship with Christ because of what's in your rearview mirror. And, of course, God's trying to get us to look out the front window, right? Just look out the window and go forward with me. The rearview mirror is this small little mirror in your car, but that Satan wants us to look right there and be reminded constantly of our errors and mistakes. And I think for me, what ultimately, you know, what I try and think about too, Jason, is I'm a type of person who is, I think we only fail when we stop.
Right.
Right. And so I really believe that. So everything that's happened, I can say, yes, you know what, my first marriage failed, but that doesn't mean that I have to be a failure as a husband overall in the bigger picture.
Right.
Because I can grow and learn from that and be a much better husband to Holly now, learning from what not to do, but also what should I be doing. It's two things, right? And so applying those things, be a better dad now. Even though I don't see my kids every day, how can I be a better dad now? By learning from other dads, reading, researching, what can I do, talking, trying to deepen that relationship so that
when it would be easy to retract from your sons because of that shame talk.
It would be.
Like, oh man, I blew it. I'm never going to be a good dad, blah blah blah, and it's easy to do that.
Jason, that is my honestly, you know, the biggest fear that Satan wants to crawl into my head and get into is to fail as a dad.
Mm.
You know, it's one thing to me, there's kind of like as a in a marriage, there's still that other adult who's involved, and you know, if my wife tomorrow decided she didn't want to be married to me anymore, it's a two-way street, right? But being a dad, like, I'm always going to be their dad, right? So
right.
They can't divorce me as their dad. So it's that idea of no matter what, I'm going to be their dad, and I want to be at least when they look back in life, that they see a dad who loved and cared about them and supported them and no matter what, believed in them and helped them grow into strong Christian young men, and in spite of our situation, didn't let that stop or hinder us from having the best relationship we could.
Yeah, and all that stuff, all those negative things, it's a liar. Because what it won't tell you is, look, man, 10 years is going to go by regardless.
Oh, yeah.
15, 20 years, it's coming, right? And, you know, your kids, you know, they're going to look back and be, you know, one way or the other, you know, it's my dad. And it could be either, man, he did a great job under some tough circumstances. He really made the effort, and we're really tight, and I really admire him, you know, or it could be something else. And so I appreciate you sharing that. So you enter this new life, you meet Holly, and you come down to Indiana to Region 8 Education Service Center.
Yeah.
So what is a service center, and what's your role there?
That's quite the transition here.
How about that, huh? We're just jumping right ahead.
It's a good segue.
Well, so, you know, because and part of that is because Holly's in Fort Wayne, right?
Yes. Yeah, so make it as short as possible. My ex-wife, after we got divorced, she wanted to move back to Indiana, where she's from originally, and all the research I had looked into said that it's important for her to make sure, as a mom, single mom now, that she's going to feel support, has a support structure around her.
Right.
So I supported her moving back to Indiana, even though my job was still in Detroit.
And could you have nixed that? Because I think in Indiana, you got to get the other spouse if you want to.
It's same for Michigan, yes.
Yeah,
yes.
You doubled down and said, no, I'm going to support you. I want you to be the best mom you can be to the boys.
Correct.
Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah, and which was really hard because I thought that I was going to be able to find a job in Indiana about the same time. And this was also about the same time I'm meeting Holly. So what happens is I meet Holly, we begin our relationship. I start looking for jobs, and I have no contacts in Northeast Indiana at the time. My teaching career had been down in Bloomington and at Eastern Hancock, down east of Indianapolis. So I have no contacts here. So I'm like cold calling, cold mailing, cold applying. And of course, not, you know, understandably, I'm not getting a ton of, you know, positive feedback.
Yeah, you're going for volume, but at this point, are you in like, I'm gonna shotgun this and hope I don't, or were you just like in full prayer mode of like?
I'll tell you, I was still being somewhat intentional because obviously I still had to provide for my boys. Sure. I had to be able to support myself. So I was being somewhat intentional. But at the same time, definitely a lot of faith going on. And I end up at Region 8 this. So after a year, this is, again, I'll try and tell this as quickly as I can. Holly and I get married, and I still have a job in Detroit. She's here in Fort Wayne. So our first year of marriage is, and this is with first year of marriage with now boys living in Pendleton area, down in Pendleton, closer to Indianapolis, and my job in Detroit. So now I'm coming, you know, Friday night after work, driving back to Fort Wayne, trying to schedule time with my wife, and now trying to go down and see my boys for that whole year, and doing my job and looking for a new job. Crazy time. Do not recommend that for people who are going into a second marriage.
This is not a long-term plan.
What happens then is the Region 8 position opens up. I didn't even know what a service center was. In Michigan, we have what are called intermediate school districts, which are in a somewhat equivalent structure. Basically, what it is, it's a organization between the level of the Department of Education and the local school district that provides a level of services and support and resources to the local districts that they might not be able to provide for themselves or that we can do based on a consortium or cooperative basis. The position of executive director comes open there. And as I look at the position, it looks like a job that I think I could be good at and would enjoy doing. But literally, Jason, I look at the requirements and I have none of them. I mean, you have to be in a superintendent. I've never been a soup. You have to have a soup's license in Indiana. Didn't have that. You have to have extensive networks in Northeast Indiana. I was like, okay, I can name my wife and that's about it, right? So it's like, but I knew one of my skills, networking is one of my skill sets, as it is for you. You're an excellent networker. I love going out meeting new people, new organizations.
I don't know if I'm a networker or a professional kidnapper, but, you know.
You will come. Yeah, you're my friend and you'll meet my other friends.
That's right.
But honestly, Jason, I didn't even apply for it.
Really?
I didn't even apply for it. I was like, man, it looks great, but all I'm going to do is I'm going to irritate these superintendents who are going to see my application and be like, this guy doesn't have one thing on the job requirement list. And luckily, what had happened was the previous year, I had come down and I had interviewed for a principal position for a local school district here. Mm-hmm. I had one round interview, and I realized, wait a minute, if I take this gig – remember, I've been a high school principal before,
right.
14-hour days. The district was just slightly north of and west of Fort Wayne. I'm now, I don't know, 45 minutes outside Fort Wayne, another hour 10 to Pendleton to see my boys, on top of 14-hour days. Basically, I would have eliminated weekdays being able to see them, plus any Saturday activities that come up, games, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
Whereas I'm working a central office gig in Detroit, okay, yeah, it's still 2.5 hours away, but it's central office. Let's not get crazy, right? I have a little more flexibility.
You're not covering junior high basketball games on Tuesdays.
That is correct.
Yep. Gotcha.
I got the clearance to not have to cover football games on Friday nights. And so this superintendent had remembered me, and she reached back out to me and says, Josh, I think you should apply for this position. And I was like, are you sure? And I went in and I sold myself as this non-traditional candidate. You know, as you know me, Jason, I said, you may want this, but here's what I can do. Here's how I will do all of these things. Here's how I'm a proven networker. Here's how I build these organizations. Here's how I go about doing things. And here's the leadership things. Here's my beliefs in education. And I'm grateful because this board of 11 superintendents from Northeast Indiana at the time took a chance, I think, with me and said, Josh, you know, yeah, you're kind of a non-traditional. Usually it's a retired superintendent who takes this job. Here I am at 40 years old, and never been a superintendent, and saying, here are the reins, and here you go. So as executive director, I'm in charge of overseeing our daily operations of our organization. I do a lot of work with superintendents, with principals, some with teachers. I have a colleague who organizes a lot of our professional development offerings and meeting structures to help really bring educators together to help them network and collaborate and help support themselves as they take on these very difficult and challenging roles and tasks within K-12 education.
I just want to interrupt that. There's something to be said, and something I tell my kids all the time. It's not who you know, it's not what you know, it's both.
Right? True.
And people can often poo-poo networking or spending time with people, getting to know them at conference and stuff. You never know where that leads.
You never know.
I had an opportunity to earn a role over over 100 candidates that were probably better qualified. And I would say, one, that was a God thing. And two, God gave me the idea to call the personal assistant of the person that was hiring me and just ask. Because I'm a big believer in just asking.
Yeah.
What's the worst you can hear? No.
Yeah.
And this is not devastating. It's just you're going to hear no. It was, hey, what do you think they're looking for in a candidate? And she said, well, you know what? There's a lot of things here. I'll just send you her notes.
Oh.
I had the notes. my presentation was point by point through the notes.
That is great. But you know what? You make a great point, Jason. What I did that really helped me was I called another director at another ESC, again, who didn't know me.
Sure.
I cold called them. I said, look, here's the deal. I'm applying for this job up here. Tell me about the role. What's going on? And this guy was great. He spent, I scheduled the time with him, but he spent 45 minutes on the phone talking me through what's going on in the state and what the roles of the ESCs are and how it's changed over time. And so kind of like with you, I was empowered with some background information, and what I almost always do that with jobs. When I interviewed for this job at a local school district for the principal a year earlier, I went and met with the mayor. Mm-hmm. Right? I went and met with whoever I could find on that day to meet me for 10 minutes, and I just told them what I was doing. I'm interviewing for the high school principal job. I just want to meet a few people and learn more about what's going on here. And so I dropped that during the interview, right? Like, So same sort of thing in this case. When I was talking to one of the service center directors about what it means to be, to lead an ESC, and there's some things they talked about. So in other words, I think what I try and do is show that take initiative, right? And you took initiative. You went. What can I do to help separate myself from other candidates? What bit of knowledge or information can I acquire that's going to help me better understand what's expected, but what they're looking for to see if this is the right fit. And I have been very blessed. I have I'm governed by a group of 11 superintendents who form my executive board, who meet monthly with us. And what they've allowed me to do is take what I'm good at and shape that into what I get to do. And so, as you know, for anyone in any job, if we're able to use our strengths and what we're naturally gifted at on a regular basis, and we're not asked to do things that are not our strengths, and like things that, because what things that are not our strengths are things that we don't find very pleasing or enjoyable, right? I mean,
yeah.
So for me, I do not like routine. I am not a guy who wants to come to the same office, the same cubicle every single day and punch and be.
Sure.
I get restless. I get antsy. I get cabin fever. And so I've said, are you guys okay if I go out and like actually go and visit schools and talk to superintendents on your own turf? And they're like, yeah, that's what we want you to do. And so, oh, great. And right. So, again, I've been able to shape it to a position that is helping the organization accomplish what it needs to be doing, but at the same time gives me a lot of great personal fulfillment and satisfaction. I'm engaged with economic development groups in the area, other professional groups, higher ed, and that sort of thing. So for me, there's a selfish part of that in that I enjoy doing that, but at the same time, I view it as part of my job. So I don't know where the line crosses between, hey, that sounds like fun, and oh yeah, sure, it's also part of my job, right? So
let's talk about that. And yeah. I just wanted to know, one, do you have a clone? Because you're getting a lot done. So,
oh man,
you are. And I'd like to double down and
okay,
kind of dig into the Strength Finders in a bit.
But, sure.
Are you still the Indiana director for
Indiana ASCD?
Yeah. ASCD.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm handing that role off, but yes, as of today, yes.
Okay. So
that's been 5 years. So.
My goodness. So and that's an international organization, right?
Yeah.
That supports educators and mm-hmm, all the way up to superintendent and mm-hmm, curriculum development, things mm-hmm, like that, supervision. and you are, you know, you're traveling a lot in this role mm-hmm. as, you know, is this kind of new universe of being a dad that, mm-hmm. you know, so you're at like athletic events mm-hmm. that are far away.
Yeah.
You know, so a Tuesday night might yeah. be like, well, we're driving. And yeah. Honestly, I don't know how you not put on 40 pounds going to Ivanhoe's. If I had to travel past Ivanhoe's as much as you do, I'd yeah. be on my 600-pound life, honestly.
I have to be careful.
But Holly says, keep on going.
That's right.
So you're, and if anybody doesn't know, Ivanhoe's is a wonderful place outside of Upland.
It
and
is.
If
you creep Highly on recommend
my,
it.
Oh, yeah. If you creep on my Instagram, I find reasons to go there. I've coached kids into regionals at track. And one of the things I look forward to, because it's at Indiana Wesleyan across the interstate, I just look forward to taking those kids to Ivanhoe's mm-hmm. just so I can get some.
Exactly.
But anyway, you know, I think about that trip, and there's not a lot along the way except that. But mm-hmm. You're traveling, you're doing all mm-hmm. this, and you come, you know, because you're not busy, right? You're totally not busy at all. You come across Strength Finders.
Yeah.
And tell me, how did you get connected with Strength Finders, and what did you learn?
So my first connection with Strength Finders was back in 2014. The pastor at my church at the time, we were getting ready to work on a project together, and our church leadership team was going and using Strength Finders. And before we started on this project, he gives me the book and says, okay, Josh, don't read the book. At the very end, there's this little code to take this assessment. Just take the assessment. And then tell me the results when you get done. By the way, that's not how you're supposed to do this, by the way. So that's not at all how that's supposed to work. But nonetheless, that was my first exposure. So I took this assessment, and basically it's about 170-plus questions. It's online. And basically asks, you get each question is kind of two opposing. They're not even opposing. There's two viewpoints. What do you like to do this or do you like to do that? Do you see things this way or do you see things that way? Do people say this about you or this? And you have like a slider, and you basically slide the slider to which one you strongly agree with.
It's
sort
of like sorting algorithm, like the answer predicts the next answer or question. It's
always the same 177 questions, okay. But the algorithms behind that are exactly how you use the slider, then how those all interconnect with. There are what researchers have found. This is a Gallup based product. There's 34 strengths that we all possess in differing orders and different intensities. And by accessing and identifying what our top, at least what our top strengths are, top five strengths are what you get from the standard assessment, you can better lean into those. And since it's what you're naturally inclined to be good at, you are able to better align those to what you do every day in your, not only just your job, but in your life, in your relationships, different roles that you have, because those strengths are present with us at all times. So it's not just at work strengths. They're like strengths that you are, it's who you are. It's part of your DNA.
Did you find out you're Batman?
Well,
I've never seen you and Batman in the same room, is all I'm saying.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah. I don't know.
So what were some strengths that you had?
So my top five strengths are maximizer, connectedness, self-assurance, woo, and adaptability.
Oh, you got a little woo in you.
A little woo. Okay. Little woo. Woo stands for winning others over, and the part of it is it's that idea that woo is your ability and willingness to kind of talk to anybody anytime, that everyone is – there's no strangers that my example is at church, my boys have to try and usher me out afterwards because I want to talk to everybody, and they're like the Secret Service trying to get the president out, trying to like, Dad, let's go.
my family hates me on Sundays.
Yes. Just when I keep talking, there's like all those kinds of people, either A, that I need to reconnect with, or B, that I'd like to meet, or that sort of thing.
Do you find yourself energized by talking to people or exhausted by talking to people?
Energized.
Yeah, I'm the same way.
And that's part of this too. That's part also how you help identify your strengths is mm-hmm. where do you get energy from? And there's nothing wrong with people who feel drained from talking to people. And it doesn't mean that people can't do what I just talked about and do it well. But to your point, do you get energy from it or are you drained? I get energy from it.
Wife. I absolutely exhaust her. Yeah. She has a look that I've learned.
Yes.
It's shut it down look.
The danger for me is I can't. So woo has one of the potential downs, a danger, I guess you want to call it that, is we can sometimes be surface in our conversations. It can be almost chit-chat-y. And so it, sometimes people can perceive that as being disingenuous. And so my wife, who her one of her top five strengths is relator, which is about depth of relationship. Sometimes if I call up just to say, hey, you know, I think
she's taking you to the deep end.
Yeah, she's like, well, Josh, if you just want to talk about the weather and
I got to go.
Right. Seriously, that's something she's, and so I have to, oh yeah, relator. She's got relator. So I need to like be, have depth. And so I have to like really think about it and talk about emotions and things like that. So,
And my son and I could take a car ride and be perfectly happy with a, like an hour length of just not talking.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, it'd be fine. Just chill.
I don't know what that's about.
But just chill and relax. Yeah. So, you know, so for me, it's been what that led to is an opportunity through a local regional economic development association that the Northeast Indiana Regional Partnership had a grant and allowed me to go and get trained as a StrengthsFinder coach. So I'm. This was a pretty decent size investment for us to do. So it was not something I could have done on my own.
If somebody wanted to connect with you and learn more about StrengthsFinders, or your work there, how would they get connected with you?
So the best way to connect with me, I'm on LinkedIn, I'm on Facebook, under Josh Wenning, JOSHWENNING. My email is joshwenning@gmail.com, and would love to talk with them more about it. We work with individuals on how to maximize, how to help them maximize their strengths and what they're doing in their life and their organization. And we also work with organizations on how do you take the skills, the strengths of your folks within your organization to help maximize those and lean into those strengths to be the best organization you can be. And it's a lot of fun because, Jason, as you know, you're talking about what people are naturally good at and not focusing on necessarily what you're bad at. And a lot of research has gone in to say that when you focus on what's right with people, you get way more out of them and they are way more engaged in what they're doing than when we focus on trying to fix what's wrong with them.
Right.
And so it's a lot of fun, and I enjoy it. And ultimately, it's talking about what God's already put inside of us. And, you know, as Christians, why would we not want to maximize what the gifts that God has given us?
Well, I really appreciate you sharing all that and, you know, giving us a glimpse into your life. And I've got about 100 more questions for you, honestly. So hopefully you can join us again.
I appreciate it. Thanks for the opportunity, Jason. Thank you.
Yeah, you did a great job. So
thank you.
Hopefully we get a chance to get into all my real good depth questions I've got at the end of here. So
I know you got a lot. You gave me a lot to think
like
about.
It.
Yes,
and I'm sure you like read it all and put notes on it, didn't you?
Well, I got through most of it, and then I got to the end. I'm like, man, there's a lot here. I was getting deep.
We haven't talked about your doctoral studies.
No,
we haven't talked about a lot of stuff. So,
that's all good though. Had a great conversation.
Great.
Appreciate
we'll get there. Thank you.
Thanks.